You remember what life was like during Prohibition? Well, neither do I. Few of us were alive then. But during Prohibition, the only way you could get a drink in America was to break the law. You might go to a place that looked like this. Appears to be a hot dog joint. But for those of us in the know, we'd walk over here to what looks like a regular phone booth. Go in, pick up the little phone, call in. This is John Stossel. Are you expecting me?
Hi, welcome to PDT.
Thank you very much. Most speakeasies, instead of a telephone, had a peephole or a secret password you'd give to the bartender to get in. And simply by buying a drink, I and the guys who sold it to me became criminals.
It was Prohibition that created the crime depicted in movies like The Untouchables. The booze dealers armed themselves, killed people, and didn't pay taxes. They corrupted cops. In fact, they became what we now call organized crime, the mob.
I want them dead.
Today, they've given up on banning booze, but now we have new Prohibition.
Nation's crack epidemic.
Prohibitions against drugs.
A drug that can kill you the first time you take it.
Found that OxyContin is more addictive than heroin.
Serious, it's epidemic proportion.
Probably the worst drug that's out there right now.
Against selling a kidney.
Lee Crescetta has admitted that he was part of a scheme to steal body parts from corpses.
Having more than one spouse.
This is a slippery slope.
Against selling sex.
At one point, this was somebody's little girl who's now prostituting herself out.
But do these prohibitions make us safer or less safe? They certainly make us less free.
I had 7 cop cars come to my house at 10 till 6 in the morning to arrest me and take me to jail.
And now, the man who shatters conventional wisdom, John Stossel.
Today, looking back on alcohol prohibition, everyone agrees it was a disaster. It didn't stop people from drinking, but it created crime. People understand that now, but they say that other current prohibitions against drugs, prostitution, and so forth are different. Drugs, people say, are much more dangerous than alcohol. Prostitution, polygamy, and drug use all degrade our culture and send the wrong message to young people. But is that true? Or is most everything you think you know wrong? Let's start with drugs.
It is true that drug use has wrecked many people's lives.
Don't let drugs get in the way of your dreams.
But prohibition activists made similar claims about alcohol. This engraving described the drunkard's progress. It all starts with a glass with a friend. Soon it becomes a glass too much with your jolly companions. That leads to poverty, disease, desperation and crime, and finally, death by suicide. It's pretty similar to today's anti-drug ads.
This is your brain. This is heroin. This is what happens to your brain after snorting heroin. And this is what your body goes through. It's not over yet.
This is what your family goes through! And your friends and your money!
Any questions?
They say drugs are more addictive than alcohol.
Marijuana is an intoxicating, mind-muddling drug. Its use can lead to abnormal behavior, to psychological dependence.
And the newest drugs are the worst ever.
Worst drug that's out there right now.
They said I wouldn't get hooked after the first hit.
Scary. But is what they say true?
We're also seeing a lot of kids literally die from it, overheating, impact on kidneys, heart tissue, etc. We're also, we think, down the line going to see a tremendous spinoff in young women who are vulnerable to sexual assault.
That was General Barry McCaffrey. Then the drug czar talking about ecstasy. But as ecstasy got popular, there was no increase in sexual assault. So I have to wonder about some of these warnings. I also wonder, because I read the book Saying Yes by Jacob Sullum. The yes refers to drug use, not abuse, use. Jacob Sullum joins us now. You say much of what we're told about drugs is just wrong?
Yeah, that's in a nutshell. I think the concerns that you heard raised by Barry McCaffrey are concerns that people legitimately raise about a number of drugs, but most conspicuously, alcohol. I mean, certainly alcohol is much more strongly associated with sexual assaults and other kinds of regrettable sexual behavior than ecstasy or any illegal drug is.
But that's because more people drink.
Well, it's not. Not just because of that. If you look at the actual incidence among users of these kinds of problems, alcohol is much more likely to be associated with that sort of problem. The vast majority of people who use illegal drugs do not become heavy users, do not become addicts. It does not disrupt their lives. And in fact, I would argue, it enhances their lives. And I think the reason that people find it easy to accept what the government says is that when you have prohibition, the most visible users are the ones who are most antisocial, most screwed up. They're the ones who come to the attention of the police, of the prosecutors, of the judges, of the social workers, of the psychiatrists. I have a brother who says, you know, you wrote this book about well-adjusted drug users, and I accept that that's possible. But I'm telling you, the majority of people I see who are drug users, they're completely screwed up. Well, of course, he's a psychiatrist. Those are the people he sees. I think that people who present themselves as experts on drug use because they come into contact with all of these addicts have a very skewed perspective because they're seeing a biased sample. The people who are well-adjusted and responsible users are invisible.
Okay, well, let's hear from someone on the other side who actually probably sees the people having trouble. Ron Brooks is president of the National Narcotics Officers Association, and he joins us from New Orleans. So you've heard what Jacob Sullum says. I assume you strongly disagree.
You know, I do strongly disagree. And I think, you know, first of all, the argument, the alcohol argument, is a great argument. The fact is, you know, crime went down dramatically during Prohibition. I mean, we saw drugs or alcohol sales crimes go up, but the domestic violence, the highway accidents, the workplace accidents, the violence in the bar rooms, you know, the ability of people to take care of their families, that went down. And alcohol use dropped dramatically. And in fact, we didn't reach the same per capita level of alcohol consumption until the 1960s. I mean, prohibition did work.
Prohibition was a good thing?
In some regards.
How come we got rid of it by public acclaim?
Well, I would correct a couple of things.
Because people like to drink. But we also have to remember that, you know, people can drink socially. Nobody uses crack socially or heroin socially. I mean, those are drugs that are taken to get high, to be intoxicated. You know, people don't necessarily drink a glass of wine or one martini or one beer to be high, but people use crack or PCP or heroin or others for the sole reason of being high.
First of all, murder rates went up during Prohibition. And it's not true that the violence declined, and it was fed by the Prohibition law.
60% of the kids that don't use pot say, hey, I don't use pot because it's illegal. I mean, clearly, legal prohibitions, you know, keep availability down, they keep price up, they keep the antisocial stigma message alive, and our abstinence-based policy in America has reduced in dramatically declining drug use. 1979 till today's date, we've reduced illegal drug use in this country 50%. We have saved lives, we have kept kids in school.
Ron, what about the argument that making it illegal causes the crime? That the drug dealers arm themselves and form gangs because they can't rely on the police because they're illegal.
Well, you know, there certainly is some of that. But let me tell you that there's a lot more drugs. If you look at Bureau of Justice Statistics and NIJ stats, there are a lot more crimes associated with people that are high on drugs, lose their inhibitions, violent crime associated with it. Clearly, domestic violence, violence against children, workplace accidents, highway deaths.
Jacob Sullum, I give you
now,
the last
now,
word.
Well, it's
now in this.
We hear you, Ron.
The association with violence is much stronger in the case of alcohol. We do not, therefore, conclude that we should ban alcohol. We tried that; it did not work out well.
We
repealed prohibition, and the point is that the same distinctions we apply to alcohol can and should be applied to illegal drugs. You cannot simply assume that all use is abuse without further evidence.
Thank you, Jacob Sullum and Ron Brooks.
84% of all family violence associated with
meth. Thank you very much.
Crack.
Hang on. Coming up, the scare of the moment. Used to be crack babies. Now it's cold medicine. When we return. Seems like every year there's a new drug scare, a new epidemic. And every time the prohibitionists say, this one is the worst yet.
The scourge of crack cocaine is destroying neighborhoods and perverting families.
25 years ago, crack was destroying America.
Among those paying the heaviest price are the children.
Crack babies, we were told, were unlovable, unteachable, running around like rats. But it turned out it just wasn't true.
Based on our experience, our clinical experience, we really weren't seeing these kind of horrible, sweeping, detrimental effects of prenatal cocaine exposure.
A report in the Journal of the American Medical Association concluded crack babies didn't do any worse than kids born to moms who smoke or drink.
And in terms of the behavior, there also really don't seem to be very many behavioral effects.
The next big drug hysteria grew out of rave parties.
Acid, ecstasy, nitrous, pot.
But it's the ecstasy, little pills like these Greensboro police seized last summer, that's blossomed in popularity. Take one, and you've taken what those out on the street call a hit.
Oh no, a hit, we were told, could kill you.
About a drug that can kill you the first time you take it.
Then the hysteria moved on to pain pills.
What makes OxyContin so irresistible?
I found that OxyContin is more addictive than heroin.
And the next so-called epidemic.
It's epidemic proportion.
Meth.
I have never seen a drug that is as addictive.
But the drug warriors constantly say that.
Probably the worst drug that's out there right now.
So they conduct raids.
45 times each day in the U.S., a methamphetamine lab is busted.
And the news media report their ridiculous claims.
An estimated 1 in 4 teenagers uses meth.
1 in 4 teenagers uses meth. The actual number is closer to 1 in 1,000. Joining me now to talk about the drug war is Reason TV's Nick Gillespie. Let's start with that 1 in 4 crazy statistic. Why would reporters go with that? Why do the cops say things like that?
I don't know, because I'm not a cop. I know I'm a journalist, and I know that most journalists are actually pretty stupid, and that they're incredibly credible when you have somebody in a uniform, whether it's a policeman's uniform, whether it's a nurse or a doctor or an expert in a lab coat telling you something. Journalists like to pretend that they are they push back, but they're actually very deferential to authority, and they take this seriously. On top of that, you know, we all know that sex on drugs sells even more, and that's usually what happens, because kids don't just take meth or ecstasy or LSD or you name it. They do that, and then they have sex. That becomes a very sexy story, and journalism likes to sell a lot of copy, and that this helps it. And there's a whole machinery in place to kind of push the idea. There is a new drug. It's targeting kids. It's targeting the middle class. It's coming to your hometown, and
magazine,
it is exotic.
Magazine covers have terrorized us about the scents, and we have some of them up here, one after the other. And all these new substances are much worse than alcohol. Yep. And I think we all have a sense that crack, meth, is not like alcohol. You take it once, you're hooked forever.
Obviously, is not true, because there are many more people who have tried crack or cocaine or methamphetamine or LSD or ecstasy or heroin than there are habitual users. In fact, I mean, when you look at something like methamphetamine, 0.1% of adults in America over the ages of 12, people over the age of 12, say they have tried in the past 30 days. There are, you know, it's clearly not instantly addictive. Law enforcement, for its end, law enforcement substance abuse counselors, you know, all sorts of social agencies, they have a vested interest in saying, look, we've got a new terrifying problem. We're going to need more resources. We're going to need more help. We're going to need more rules to keep people and to really go after this. We need tanks. We need battering rams. We need whatever.
And if it's a big crisis, they get more money. And I mean, I think they mean well, and they want to protect people. But all these prohibitions have unintended consequences. We have a tape of a couple of them.
Have you tried to buy cold medication lately? One of the more effective decongestants is pseudoephedrine. And because pseudoephedrine can be used to make meth, states have ordered drugstores to restrict its sale, put it behind the counter, and to write down who buys it. Some stores do it voluntarily.
It's hoping the state won't need to intervene if stores like Hy-Vee self-police cold pill sales.
And grandmothers who buy cold medicine for several members of their family better watch out.
I had 7 cop cars come to my house at 10 till 6 in the morning to arrest me and take me to jail.
She was busted for buying too much Sudafed.
She's the Mob Barker of antihistamines, I guess, right? You know, these laws, which went into effect several years ago during the big methamphetamine scare, which was totally overplayed.
Isn't meth worse than anything?
You know what? Meth was considered so bad that it was the crack of stimulants, right, or something, which in turn had been the heroin of cocaine, et cetera.
Isn't it worse?
No. Meth, well, there's a couple of things. Lots of people use meth or amphetamines legally, such as people in the Army, pilots, certain types of truck drivers, legally. Speed can be, you know, a very effective thing. There are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of school kids who are functioning better because they're using some variant of speed. So these things do have good uses, but then you can clearly see that something has gone seriously wrong with the way that we treat drugs and the way that we treat what are considered illicit substances if you're arresting a grandmother for buying cold medicine for her grandchildren. And that shouldn't take a 7-car, you know, police bus for people to figure that out.
What's the new drug?
There is always a new drug of choice that's coming to your town that's going to, you know, lock up your sons and daughters. It's going to burn a hole through the heartland. The most recent one in the news just this past week is called K2. It is a fake marijuana. USA Today had a great headline, which was bannered, "Cops say fake pot as bad as real thing." This is a substance which authorities warn, is unregulated. It's not even illegal. It also doesn't have any actual effects on people, but it's out there, and it's going to take your kids. So be careful of that.
Thank you, Nick Gillespie.
Now, shattering conventional wisdom, John Stossel.
Now, prohibition that kills people. In 1984, a congressman named Al Gore got Congress to pass a bill that banned the sale of organs. He said selling a kidney undermines the values of our society. His supporters said that without the corrosive effect of money, more people would volunteer to donate organs. President Reagan said that the law should help increase the supply of organs, but it didn't. Today, 80,000 people wait for kidneys. Many die while waiting. Other people wait for hearts, livers, lungs. But kidneys are the big one.
Kidney problems are the reason 1/3 of 1 million Americans must get dialysis treatments every week. Dialysis is just an artificial kidney. If your kidneys don't clean your blood, these machines will. But they're not as good as a real kidney.
I've died 3 times, actually. But they kicked me out of heaven. They didn't want me there.
Christina De Leon's kidneys don't work. She's been waiting for a transplant, hoping for 6 years.
I'll dwell on it. I'm like, well, if it happens, it happens. Just do what I can while I'm here.
Dialysis time. Come on. Get up.
Doing what she can means she has to go to a clinic like this one 3 times a week.
On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I get up to go to dialysis, you know, 4:30.
At dialysis, she and the others here must lie around for 4 hours while the machines do their work. It's uncomfortable and expensive. Medicare spends $20 billion on this every year. De Leon would love to get a transplant.
God, it would be heaven.
Not only might it save her life, it would revitalize her life.
I guess it would just be freedom. It would just be freedom.
Every day, someone like you waits for an organ donation while life passes by.
Now, I would think it would be easy for her to get a transplant. We have only one heart, one liver, but we have 2 kidneys. We only need one, so I think ads like this one would persuade generous people to donate a kidney. Or at least to sign the back of their driver's license so that after their death, someone would get their kidneys.
With your help, the wait will not be in vain.
But most people don't sign the release. Far fewer donate while they're alive. So De Leon asks, why can't we offer people money for kidneys?
If that's the way you have to go to get people off the list because people are not donating, then by all means, pay them, please.
This man tried to sell his kidney on Craigslist.
Kidney's yours. Simple as that. Do this as soon as you want it done.
He didn't know it was illegal.
I got $100,000. Plus medical expenses, I could put money aside for the kids to go to college. I could pay for myself to go back to college, to get a better job.
Craigslist pulled his ad. But there is a thriving black market for kidney transplants. We're told kidneys are sold for as much as $200,000.
This guy accused of buying kidneys and then reselling them on the black market.
News reporters are outraged by the sales. They call this ring the kidney mafia.
Making money off of people's misery. Look at this scar from a guy who donated. Poor people are paid $2,000, $2,000 for a kidney. Then the buyer sells them here for as much as $180,000.
When there's a need, people will pay.
in Iraq.
It's mostly young men who try to sell one of their kidneys. They can't find a job, and they believe that this is the only way to get ahead in life. The quick cash may be tempting, though, but few understand the potentially serious consequences.
They don't understand? Or they just really need money? What is moral about laws that limit their options? But moral or not, it is illegal, and most transplant doctors say paying donors should be illegal.
Voluntary donors actually feel good about themselves. A pay donation actually is a subversive process that actually undermines voluntary donation.
Dr. Gabriel Danovich joins us now from Los Angeles. He's a kidney specialist at UCLA. And, doctor, you say paid donations would be a subversive process?
Well, yes, exactly that. You see, paid donation does not go hand in hand with voluntary donation. Contrary to what your lead-up segment showed, there have been 50,000 living voluntary donations in the United States in the last 10 years. What we need to do is encourage and facilitate more voluntary living donation. I think
but
that
we've been doing that, and there are still all these people on the waiting list.
There are a lot of people on the waiting list, John, because there are a lot of people in need. We have a lot of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity in this country. And if we don't do a lot to prevent these things, we are not going to solve it. But if we introduce paid donation, we're going to undermine voluntary donation. The two just don't go together. Moreover, the donors who have been paid don't do well. Their lives are not improved. There have been studies to show that. You know, I think we're blessed on this program to have Virginia Postrel here.
Let me introduce her, please. With me is Virginia Postrel. I don't know if your life was improved or not by this. A few years ago, Virginia gave Sally Satel a kidney. Sally is one of the few people who's gotten a kidney from a donor who wasn't a family member or a lover, just an altruistic person.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I was a friend of Sally's. But, well, look, I agree with Dr. Danovich on a lot of things. I agree that we need to encourage more people to be living donors. I think there is a lot of misunderstanding out there. I think people think that it's this horrible, traumatic, difficult thing to do. In the United States today, it can be done laparoscopically. My scar is this big. It's not like the one that you showed on the video. The recovery time is reasonable. I have a completely normal life. I'm healthy. And, in fact, not only am I healthy, but I completely unrelated to the kidney donation. I actually had breast cancer, went through all those treatments, had absolutely no problems from the kidney from having one kidney through all that. It is as good deeds could go. Giving a kidney to somebody is a lot easier than, say, mentoring a teenager.
Let me stop.
A lot of the resistance to people being paid donors comes from this misunderstanding about what's involved in the process.
Sally Satel, who received the kidney, is a doctor, and you put together a book titled Altruism is Not Enough. So you obviously disagree with Dr. Danovich.
Oh, yes. We disagree on this profoundly. I think that altruism has failed us in terms of being the sole legitimate motive for giving an organ. Look, I'm the poster girl for it, clearly, and it is a beautiful virtue. But tomorrow at this time, 13 people will be dead because they didn't get a kidney. And that is just not acceptable.
Let's put the chart up of how many people are waiting versus how many transplants there are. Dr. Danovich, you can't see this, but the yellow line on the chart you know about this.
Yeah, I know it very well. But unfortunately, if you introduce kidney selling, you will not have the Virginia Postrels around to be donors. Let me finish. Countries that have permitted kidney selling don't have related donation because someone can go and sell a kidney, and neither do they have robust programs for deceased donation for hearts and liver transplants. So you undermine the core altruism.
But hardly any countries have done it.
Yeah, Iran. I think part of it, we're comparing apples and oranges, and what we really need to be talking about is what might we have in the United States among people who live in the United States, which is a developed country, and where our health care system and our legal system are supportive of the rights of the donor or the whether paid or unpaid. And I think, yes, it is the case that if people were paid, some people would not, but on net, there would be an increase. It's like anything else.
Most things
incentives
matter. We pay for.
And in the process today, everybody gets paid except the donor.
The doctor gets paid,
the technicians get paid, the pharmaceutical companies that provide the drugs get paid, the companies that provide the equipment get paid, everybody gets paid. And also, if you go on the UCLA campus where Dr. Danovich works, and I live nearby, you will often see these signs soliciting people to donate blood. And the signs will say, donate blood, get free movie tickets. Or if you're an employee of UCLA, you get 4 hours paid leave. That would be illegal for giving a kidney.
Even free movie tickets.
Yes, that would be illegal.
Thank you very much, Virginia Pastrell, Sally Satel, Dr. Danovich. I'd like to think that my body belongs to me, that once I become an adult, I own my body, and that should mean that I can do whatever I want with it, as long as I don't hurt anyone else. But as we've seen tonight, there are lots of things our government says we may not do with our own bodies, like put certain drugs in them. Now, I have kids. My first instinct is to be glad that cocaine and heroin are illegal. It means they can't zip down to the neighborhood drugstore and buy something that gets them high. So maybe prohibition will deter them. But I don't know that. And the more reporting I've done on this, the more skeptical I get. I mean, making drugs illegal doesn't keep kids from getting the drugs. The kids say drugs are no harder to get than alcohol. Authorities can't even keep the stuff out of prisons. Why do we think we can keep it out of all of America?
Government's violent intrusion into our homes is justified because they're protecting us. After all,
the scourge of crack cocaine is destroying neighborhoods and perverting families.
But neighborhoods are really being destroyed because drugs are illegal. We don't have dangerous booze houses because you can go to a liquor store.
Organized crime syndicates in Europe and Israel have begun trafficking in the drug.
There are no organized French wine syndicates or European cheese gangs. We have drug robberies only because drugs are restricted. Our government says nicotine and heroin are equally addictive, but no one's knocking over 7-Elevens to get Marlboros. It's prohibition that causes crime.
The Netherlands has officially tolerated marijuana for 30 years. So is there violent marijuana crime? No, because buying and selling is allowed. Is everyone getting stoned? No, fewer young people in Holland smoke marijuana than do Americans. Legalization took the mystique away. A Dutch minister of health said, we've succeeded in making pot boring. Vice is part of life. I want to discourage immoral behavior, too, but outlawing it doesn't make it go away. It just drives it underground, and that makes it much worse. Prostitution may be immoral, but making it illegal doesn't make it go away. Just makes it violent and dangerous. Banning kidney sales doesn't stop kidney sales. It just makes people lie about it and sometimes kills people who obey the law. In a free country, consenting adults ought to be able to do with our own bodies or to our bodies anything as long as we don't hurt anyone else. People who don't like what we do have every right to complain about our behavior, to boycott or picket or embarrass us. And God bless the critics. They make us better people by getting us to think about what's moral. Let them mock and shame. But shaming's one thing. Government force is another. Prohibition means we empower the state to send out people with guns, to force people to do what the majority says is moral. That's not right. And it doesn't even work. And that's our program for tonight. I'm John Stossel. Thanks for watching. See you next week.